Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. How are you, Kieran?
I'm in the COVID bus at present, but should be clear pretty soon. It's just a pain in the butt. You know, we're tough, Kevin, because we've both had man flu during our life.
Indeed.
And yeah, we're well prepared for such eventualities. But yeah, the worst thing is having to miss Brighton versus Norwich, and the best thing is being able to miss Brighton versus Norwich.
Yeah, I'm a bit ahead of you, so I'm about to ring the bell at the request stop to get off the COVID bus, basically. And hopefully we'll both be well and happy because we're recording a day early this week because we've got a proper game to go to tomorrow, Kieran. We're treating ourselves to the Papa John's final.
That's right. Yeah, well, Sutton United is your neck of the woods, really, isn't it?
It's very close to us, yeah. I'm really pleased. It's great news for them.
Yep, yeah. Look forward to that.
Really look forward to that, yes, unless, of course, my Gauleiter son, Ed, allows me out of the house. It's 15 days, Ed. Even by the old metric, we're fine. It's not 15 days, actually, it's 10, because then people who went to the live show might be really worried that we were super spreading. We weren't. It was several days after that Kieran and I both tested positive on the same day, which is... not a good sign. We are definitely spending too much time together, even remotely.
Yes.
It's a question. Are we doing a pod here, Kieran? We are, aren't we? Yes, we are.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we're just basically passing the time until 3 o'clock so we can go and listen to the football. And you've done that thing that I don't approve of, Kieran, because you've decided not to go to Norwich Brighton, as you said, but you've done something, Kieran, that I can't say I approve of, putting a pound on Norwich to win.
This is referred to in technical terms as an emotional hedge.
You had me worried then, Kieran, because I know what it's referred to in technical terms, and we really wouldn't be winning a BAFTA if you use that expression.
That's right. Yes. So Norwich is 7-1 to beat Brighton. So whilst neither of us are big gamblers, when I have spoken to professional gamblers, they said always look for value. Well, for a side that has scored once in six games, which is Brighton Hove Albion, to have opponents who are 7-1 to beat them, seems to me like value.
It does seem.
And I hope I'm wrong.
Well, that's the accountant in you talking, Kieran. It's a huge game for Everton tomorrow, which by the time you listen to this pod, everybody will be yesterday, Sunday. We know they've got issues, Kieran, but they posted losses this week. Huge numbers, Kieran, big numbers. They were a massive talking point across most TV and radio football shows in the last couple of days because these are big numbers, Kieran, aren't they?
That's right. Everton have managed to lose £121 million in 2021, which takes their three-year cumulative loss. And the reason why this is important is because that forms the basis for the profitability and sustainability stroke FFP calculations. So it takes the 3 years of losses to £373 million. And people might be saying to themselves, hold on, I thought the rules were there to stop clubs making crazy losses and weren't their limits. And the limit is £105 million. So you might be saying, well, hold on, if you're only allowed to lose 105 and you've lost 373, surely something a bit strange is going on. So, and this is where Everton start coming out with a few interesting numbers. So Everton have claimed that COVID has cost them £170 million in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, that seems quite a lot because, you know, as much as I love Goodison Park, it only generates around about 750, 800 grand a match.
Yeah.
In terms of ticket sales. So anyway, how do you get from there to 170 million? They sort of came up with a few other things and they were saying, oh, yeah, and we would have sold some players and made a lot of money selling those players, but COVID, I think the technical phrase is, took the arse out of the market.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, okay, that does seem a bit excessive. What are other clubs doing who have also published their accounts recently? So let's just get this right. Everton are saying that COVID cost them £170 million. Sheffield United, who were in the Premier League for the last two seasons, remember, said COVID cost them 21.
Yeah.
Now, is Everton a bigger club than Sheffield United? No disrespect to Sheffield United. Yeah, it is. Yeah, we know, you know, Everton's been there longer. So is there perhaps a better benchmark we could use? So I went into the Villa accounts. And, you know, think about Aston Villa, ground capacity, roughly the same. You know, Goodison and Villa Park, you know, big investment in players and so on. Villa are saying their COVID losses are 56. So we've got Sheffield United 21, Villa 56. How Everton get to 170 is another matter. But they seem adamant that it really hit them in terms of when they're trying to get rid of players. And I don't know. You know, this isn't a football show, but I think there are some fans of many clubs, including those of Everton, who say the reason why we didn't get huge prices for some of the players we've sold is because that we sold a bunch of we bought players who turned out to be not quite as good as we thought. So Everton are saying that they are in conversation with the Premier League. And they've got a good relationship, and I think the fear has been that there could be charges, that there could be sanctions, and those sanctions conceivably could involve points deductions. Now, my view is that we're into April; it's far too late to have such charges, which would result in points deductions this season. And also, by the time you collate the evidence, per time you convene a committee to make these decisions and then come up with a judgment, I think we would be into next season. And even if it was done quicker, and if the worst happened to Everton, then they'd appeal. So I don't personally see any problems this season if people are concerned. And the Premier League, if you take a look at the Premier League constitution, it's suitably loose with its words to say that the tariff of punishments, and remember, the club might not even be charged. The club is adamant that it's well within the limits, but the tariff of charges verges from everything from a sigh and a tut-tut to a wage cap, and then ultimately it could be a fine or a points deduction. So that it is something which is conceptually there, but from a practical point of view, I consider it to be highly unlikely.
And of course, there is another problem for Everton, Kieran, in that one of their big financial backers, the man who bought the naming rights to the training ground, is on the sanctions list. That's not going to help, is it?
That's right. And speaking to some people who've been talking to the club, I've been asking, what exactly is the score there? Is it all dead with regards to the relationship between the club and Mr. Usmanov? And these journalists said, well, the club seemed to say the relationship is suspended rather than terminated. So we'll have to wait and see, because he has spoken about taking up this naming rights option for the new stadium, it's going to be an expensive piece of work to put together. So recouping as much money as quickly as possible in relation to that will be of paramount concern for the club, I'm sure. But they say that they're safe from price rises in materials and labour. They seem to think they've got a fixed price deal of sorts. So we'll wait and see. Yeah, but not great. Not great. I mean, to lose over £100 million quid for 3 years on the trot, Chelsea and Manchester City critics will say, well, they did the same, but they won trophies as well. Yeah, Everton are in a relegation fight. Mm. So there is a significant difference, I think, in terms of the success, in terms of how the money's been spent.
And I presume the other problem for football clubs at the moment, Kieran, is the same as it is for 80% of the population. Their utility bills are going to be going through the roof in the next 3 or 4 months, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, today is April the 2nd, and living where I do in Sussex, which is quite high, yesterday was the first day of the new tariffs, and we had snow here. Because I'd actually said to the Baroness, well, you know, we're down south, it's spring, you know, we won't need the heating for the next 6 months, and by 11 o'clock it was bloody blizzard.
Well, presumably down here, you just throw a few extra cedar logs on the fire, don't you? And I'm sure I've always imagined your house to have one of those big banks of logs either side of the old front door that Finlay sits on looking proud and barking at postmen. Now, another news story. We do quite often talk about stains on this show, Kieran, but normally before and after we actually record the pod. But this is bad news for Staines Town fan. I'm not entirely sure while this has happened, but they've temporarily suspended all of its operations, including competitive fixtures. And it's the club that have made that decision, isn't it?
Yes. This was an announcement from the club, which was sort of one of those drop your bacon sandwich moments when you read the press release. Mm. Staines Town have made accusations against an organisation, sort of an investment fund called Downing LLP, who it refers to as its landlord, but I don't think that it is its landlord. I think the landlord is the Thames Club. And, in a fairly emotional press release on the website, it accused Downing of being involved and, I quote, and tick these off, emotional crimes, price fixing, deforestation, we've got a gadget for that if they are, forced evictions, human rights abuses, child labour, slavery, gender discrimination, murder, crikey, fraud, and breaching Russian sanctions. Now, even Uncle Terry would say that's a charge sheet and a half, and he's had a few in his time. So this was very unusual. And there was, of course, a response from the Downing LLP investment fund, who said this is all an attempt by people at the club to deflect from the mismanagement in respect of the owner. The FA has said it notes the events at Staines Town. So they were supposed to be playing today. They are presently bottom of the Isthmian Southern Central League, having already conceded 106 goals this season, which sort of takes me back. We both played Sunday League football, Kevin, and there was always a team in your division that had conceded 106 goals, normally by sort of early to mid-February. So Staines are doing quite well there. And they have had a poor season. The club is losing money, and it's been dependent upon directors' loans. It doesn't own the ground. I think there's been an ongoing issue with regards to the playing facilities for some time. I must admit, I was so intrigued by this story. I've not really done much of the backstory research as date, but it's an incredible piece. Yeah, and the fact that a club in stage six, stage seven, step seven of football is coming out with this, and of course, then it becomes viral on Twitter, and people are just going, "What on earth is going on?" There's clearly, I think the polite way to say is a bit of a dispute between the parties.
Mm. I would make a joke at this point, Kieran, and say that my Sunday League team, Venn Street, was one of those teams that conceded a lot of goals, but the two centre-backs of that team still listen to this pod, and they would be furious because they prided themselves on the tightness of the defence. They will tell you it was up front we had problems. I still haven't got the heart to tell one of them that the only reason he was captain is because his mum had the biggest washing machine, but there you go. two issues. Sorry, Roy. Two issues on this, Kieran. First of all, you said you didn't think Downing were the technical landlords. Did I hear that right?
That's right. I think certainly as far as Downing are concerned, they don't believe themselves to be landlord. There is somebody called Thames Club, and I think Downing sort of were involved in some in some method of linking the landlord to the tenant. It is just very bizarre, to put it mildly.
So essentially what Staines Town are saying is rather than be associated with these dreadful, dreadful people who have committed these crimes, they would rather not play football and would rather suspend the club than carry on taking money from this group. Have I got that correct?
Yeah, that appears to be the case. Right. I mean, it does seem quite tenuous. Mm. If you've got evidence of things of, you know, these are very serious allegations, you would think that they would take them to the appropriate authorities and back them up with evidence, as opposed to stop playing football matches, which just seems to be a bit of an inconsistency. I'm not quite sure, you know, why of the logic of the link in the actions of Staines Town if they can evidence these accusations.
Well, this is obviously a story we'll keep following, but you would imagine that their first port of call would be the police, and then the second call would be the FA. But we'll see how that goes. It is questions time. It is questions time, actually, Kieran, because it's questions day and we've done news stories. And our first question comes from Ian Blackerby. And Ian's talking about something we have discussed on and off for a while now. Ian says, following up on your coverage of the QPR training ground bond issue last year, you'll remember, Kieran, at our live show 2 weeks ago, we heard from Wimbledon, their financial controller, about their bond scheme. It's very interesting. Ian Blackerby wants you to shed some light on the status of the shares that were issued when Chris Wright floated the club on the AIM market back in the 96-97 season. Ian says, I was still getting annual reports for my shares in the mail until a few years ago, but nothing more recently. Were the shares simply watered down over time to a tiny fraction of their original value, or is the position worse than that?
Again, going into the backstory for people not familiar with this, Chris Wright is perhaps more famous as for being the head of Chrysalis Records, which was a very successful record label. And he had the idea of merging Queen's Park Rangers with Wasps Rugby Club.
Yeah.
And he did this by setting up both clubs as subsidiaries of a company called Loftus Road PLC. And he even floated that on the stock exchange, AIM, the alternative investment market, as Ian refers to. And I think it's fair to say that the finances of Loftus Road PLC weren't great. They were paying wages, I believe wages are £130 for every £100 that were coming in. So you're making substantial losses. And probably to nobody's great surprise, Loftus Road PLC went into administration in 2001. Now, when a company goes into administration, it stops producing accounts.
Right.
So this might be why Ian's not received any accounts. And then a new company was set up, which bought the assets of Loftus Road PLC, and the shareholders of that company will now receive annual reports. But from Ian's point of view, he will not be a shareholder. So what will have happened is that Loftus Road PLC would have gone into administration, then it would have gone into liquidation, and there would have been a payout for anybody who had anything left as far as the queue was concerned. And the way that the queue works is that if you've got any mortgage holders, they get their money first. The administrators, they get their money even before first. Then the money goes to the unsecured creditors. And if there is a full dividend to those people, then money would have gone to the shareholders of Loftus Road PLC. Now, it looks as if, and gathering from the losses that were made, that there would have been nothing available for shareholders. So I think it's fair to say that if Ian does have shares in Loftus Road PLC, those shares are worthless.
Right. Now, our next question, Kieran, comes from Paul Anderson. And Paul Anderson is a Brighton fan. I've kept the question in, Kieran, as an illustration of the fact that I'm a big man. But Paul Anderson, the Brighton fan, wants to know whether it's right in any circumstances to bet on your opponents, even when they're 7-1. Paul Anderson says, when Brighton first went into lockdown and fans couldn't return, clubs and supporters did all sorts of things with season ticket money that had already been paid. At Brighton, and I suspect other Premier League clubs, we were able to put our money into the Albion As One fund, which I think players also donated some money to after criticism of footballers for not funding the NHS Again, something we spoke about very recently, Matt Hancock, throwing that dead cat onto the table. Paul says, I don't think the money went into a charitable organisation. It was administered by the club. Whilst I am totally confident that Brighton did the right thing, are you, Paul? Are you? They're totally confident that Brighton did the right thing with the money. Will there be any openness about how much went into the fund, where it came from, and how it was spent? And is that something that will be in the club's accounts?
Right. As far as this money was concerned, and it was £375,000 that was raised in total, this money was effectively transferred to and administered by Albion in the Community, which is the club's community project arm, right, which itself is under the auspices of, it's a charitable organisation, and therefore it is monitored by the Charities Commission.
So that's the foundation, basically.
That's the foundation.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
So all of that money can be linked to individual projects, and if Paul goes to onto the website, there will be a list of the organisations. They were there were some interesting ones. There was Chomp, which was a local food charity. The club and the foundation, they were getting lots of people saying, well, yeah, we've got a good idea, we've got to do. And the trouble is, you've got lots of people who are saying, we've got, my mate's doing this, that, and the other. You've got to go through due process because the Charities Commission does monitor things.
Of course.
So there were things such as, I know this was quite big in Brighton, there was cabs for jabs, because when the vaccination scheme started, there were elderly people, there were people who had other issues who couldn't get to the vaccination centres.
Yeah.
So what they did was that they funded taxis to go to the houses of people who were sheltering, vulnerable, old, unable to travel, using other means, didn't have the resources to do so, and they took them to the vaccination centres, and they took them back. So this was good. A, it increased the number of people getting vaccinated. B, taxi drivers didn't have any money during lockdown.
Yeah, of course.
So there were some quite innovative schemes involved. But if Paul does go to the club website, it is all laid out as to all of the different bodies to whom money was donated and distributed. Now I've looked at them. They've listed them out. They've not put the numbers for individual charities. And this is simply to stop people say, well, my charity got 10 grand. Why did yours get 15? The important thing was that a value decision was made at the time by the trustees, and the money all has been distributed. So it won't go through the club accounts because it went into effectively a separate bank account. The money was transferred and then it went into the charitable, the foundation arm.
The other good thing about things like cabs for jabs is that for a lot of old people, that taxi driver would be the first person they'd spoken to for quite some time as well, which is...
Or more likely listen to.
Or listen to, probably both of them sitting in the cab and going, for the love of God, will you shut up? What's important about Paul's question is that, of course, I knew the answer would be, as you said, there would be complete openness, but it just illustrates that Brighton are one of 92 other clubs and more across English football that did the right thing at the time. I'm on about to say, though, Kieran, that you mentioned that charity called Chomp. I'm on about to say that if Chomp goes wrong, would they then be Wonky Chomp? There you go. Don't get many opportunities to throw that reference in.
Exactly.
Emlyn Riley has a question that comes up virtually any time I go into a pub or go to a football game. Somebody will ask me this question, and I'm sure you get asked it all the time. It's an indication of how seriously people take business ownership models in English football. Emlyn Riley's question is simply, are there any examples of clubs that are using unique financial models to climb the divisions without millionaire owners? Or are the structures of the league and the financial pressures simply too difficult for unique business models to develop?
I think that we are seeing different things. We did have Peter McCormack on the show a few weeks ago with regards to Bedford. Now, that's an ongoing story. I will simply say to people, follow it up. I think we have had some clubs that have taken approaches. So Brentford are currently in the Premier League. They are the 50th team in the Premier League. And one of the things that Brentford decided to do was to get rid of their academy. Instead to use a combination of data analytics and setting up a B team. And the purpose of a B team is that they don't have kids at the ages of 8, 9, 10, 11, and so on, because I think the view taken by Brentford was that if any of those kids turned out to be any good, given that they're in London, there's so many scouts from other clubs, they simply get snaffled. But what Brentford have done is that they've taken the people that have been released at the ages of 16 and 17 by the bigger clubs in London, and they've tried to get those people into a squad who then goes and plays a series of friendlies, lots of these matches on the continent, and so on, to get experience with a view to getting them into either into the first team or into a position whereby they could go out and be sold. So that's one model, which I'd say has worked. We do have fan-owned clubs who have taken what can only be described as a break-even model. And why is that unique? Well, we've just been talking about Everton losing, you know, 300 odd million in 3 years. Yeah, to have this concept of football of let's make the club community-based and sustainable by not spending beyond its means is pretty unique. If you compare that to all of the common narrative, there's been many football clubs who publish their accounts on the 31st of March because they have to do that 9 months after their year end. Most clubs have a 30th of June year end. So I've spent most of the last 48 hours when I'm not blowing my nose and stuffing myself full of paracetamol. Just going through, adding to the spreadsheet, and then getting phoned up by journalists to say, "Well, I've just seen that you've tweeted that our local club has lost so much money. How much money can we spend in the next transfer window?" That was the most common question. So, well, hold on, the club's losing money. How much can we spend? And that is the narrative. So there are some clubs who say, "Well, actually, we're not. It's not how much money we can spend in the transfer market. It's how can we set ourselves a sustainable budget?" So that's fairly unique. I think there's also some clubs that have gone down the sort of, can we generate more money on non-match days? So we've historically we've had Bolton with the hotel at Bolton.
Yeah.
I know at Tranmere they're trying to develop sort of fan areas which are open on 7 days a week, and so on, and building up relationships as a community club and so on. So there are different models from the sort of the traditional ones, but are they in the Premier League? Well, Brentford are, but it's tough.
Yeah. Try not to blow your nose on a spreadsheet, Kieran, won't you? So it would be right. It would get difficult. I mean, you took the words out of my mouth. The problem is, of course, that Emily's question was about climbing the divisions, and you've always said that League One is probably the peak of the ambition for a fan-owned club. And as you say, Brentford are not going to be winning the Premier League anytime soon. So essentially, being owned by a country or a billionaire is pretty much the only way you're going to win the title, isn't it? So this is a specific question about something I must admit I wasn't aware was going on, Kieran, which doesn't necessarily narrow anything down on this pod, to be perfectly honest. But Lloyd Reddin says, can you elaborate on the case of the administrators who are being ordered to pay compensation to Rangers? Does the money have to come out of their own pockets? Where will the money go? Why are they having to pay it?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say that there are people that know 1,000 times more about this than I do. And that's probably 99% of the city of Glasgow, because whenever you mention Rangers and administration or liquidation, then social media becomes very, very irate with people who either support Rangers or Celtic. But to go back into history, Rangers went into administration. There was a company called Duff and Phelps, which was the administrators. There were charges made. There were allegations made. The administrators themselves defended themselves, and they ended up with a claim of £21 million for for the way that they were being treated and being prosecuted in terms of lost earnings. They said they suffered from loss of reputation. At the same time, if you think that the way to think of administrators is a bit like ICU at a hospital. It's right. You know, think of the administrators as the intensive care unit. The aim is to try to get the patient into a stronger position and then sell the company on. Liquidators are the undertakers of a company. Once a company has gone out, once you have sold the assets of the club in administration to somebody else, there's still something to clear up, and that's what the liquidators do. Well, the liquidators said in their view, the administrators could have controlled costs to a greater degree, and therefore they tried to sue they sued the administrators, and they were awarded £3.4 million. So that may or may not go to appeal. I've Googled and sort of looked at things on social media. I think there is a show to be done on this, but I think that show is best done by somebody who has a closer investment in this than we are. We try to cover 150 to 200 clubs in the whole of the UK. This is an issue of such forensic detail. And there's a couple of fantastic websites which go through things literally on a day-by-day basis in terms of various tax cases and so on. So the long and the short of it is that the administrators were successful in respect of what was some form of malicious prosecution on them, and the liquidators appear to have had some success with regards to a claim against the administrators. Now, where will that money go to? The purpose of the liquidators is to gather as much money together as they can and then distribute that money to the creditors of the company, which was originally administration, now in liquidation and so on.
So basically what you're saying is, Kieran, we're okay as a pod if you want detail, but if you want forensic detail, you need Swiss Ramble.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, fair enough. I accept that. I'm quite pleased that we do detail. Excuse me. Quentin Solden has a question. There's another question that people ask, often slightly cynically. Quentin says, how can the new owners of Newcastle, or any club for that matter, get around splashing lavish amounts of cash on an improved squad without contravening FFP rules?
Okay. As we know, Mike Ashley, not the most popular man in the Northeast, as far as Newcastle fans are concerned. The accusations that were made at him was that he didn't invest in the club. He certainly spent very little on infrastructure. The spending in terms of transfers was modest. And therefore, based on my calculations, Newcastle had a financial fair play profit of around about £100 million when the club was sold to PIF. Now, as we've established earlier today, you're allowed to lose £105 million. So this means that the new owners have wiggle room. You can go from plus 100 to minus 105. So that allows you to spend a lot of money in the transfer market. And remember, thanks to our friend amortization, if you sign a player for £50 million on a five-year contract, then the cost for FFP purposes is 50 million divided by five. It's only 10 million a year. Mm. So this is why Newcastle have, in theory, and I think a few of us, including Swiss Ramble, have done some calculations on this. Could Newcastle spend £500 or £600 million in the transfer market and stay within the limits of FFP? The answer would appear to be yes. And this is the paradox. Part of that is thanks to Mike Ashley, because he actually left the club with an inheritance, in the sense that it allowing the new owners to spend significant sums.
So that's very interesting. So Mike Ashley's reluctance to spend money, would this have been something that the new owners would have looked into and investigated and said, hang on a second here, this is not a loophole, because it's quite clearly open and obvious to anybody. But is this something they would have taken into consideration? They've gone, hang on a second, we've got the ability to spend big here without getting into trouble.
Well, yeah, they will have done due diligence. They will have received copies of the most recent PNS calculations, and presuming that that the people advising them are familiar with the rules, then they'd say, well, this allows us to spend, first of all, on wages, but B, in terms of transfer fees, substantial amounts of money. We've already seen that Newcastle United they spent one third of the total of the Premier League in the January 2022 window, and they're in a very strong position to spend money. There's two ways of spending money. A, can you spend it if physically, in the sense of do you have the cash there? Well, yeah, we know that the PIF owners do have those funds. And secondly, can you stay within the FFP limits? Well, again, there's a big tick as far as Newcastle are concerned in relation to that. So they have the opportunity to spend. They have the capacity to spend. Do they have the willingness to spend? Well, that's what we'll find out this summer.
Well, do you know what? If I was Mike Ashley, I'd be demanding a lap of honour and the keys to the city and an apology from 60,000 people and an open-top bus ride around the whole of the road. Speaking of which, I haven't told you this, Kieran. I thought I'd save it for a public moment. The landlord of the Pawson's Arms has done something which is either the most perspicacious business deal of the century or the most optimistic thing I've ever heard. He's hired Croydon's only two open-top buses.
Has he?
Yeah.
Is this for the day after Wembley?
He's got in first, just in case we win the FA Cup and the club are going to have to pay him a fortune to have one of the open-top buses or cut the top of a double-decker bus, one or the other. Gordon Gall has a question. And Gordon says that clubs in League One and Two receive solidarity payments from the Premier League, but far less than what the Championship clubs receive. Again, a topic we've been talking about a lot recently. Would it be advantageous, therefore, says Gordon, for League One and League Two clubs to pull this money together and reorganise into a new North-South Tier 3 to spread the money evenly across the 48 clubs? I don't know about necessarily having a regional Tier 3, because most clubs at that level are against it, but would it be advantageous for them to pull that money together and split it?
I'm not sure about that. Again, for those people unfamiliar, solidarity payments are a share of the Premier League TV money, which is given to clubs in the EFL. And it's linked in perpetuity to future TV deals. So if the Premier League has successful negotiations, yes, the Premier League clubs will do very well, but the EFL will get a share of that. Now, the way that the money is distributed at present is that clubs in the Championship get 80% of that, so it works out as around about £4.5 million per club. And to put that into some form of context, they get around £2.5 million from the EFL's own TV deal. So the Premier League is actually paying substantially more than the EFL is generating from its own TV deal. 12% goes to clubs in League One, so that's around about £675,000, £700,000, and 8% goes to clubs in League Two. I think what Gordon's suggesting is to split the difference between those last two payments and both get around about 570, 580. So yeah, we're talking about £120,000 more for 24 clubs and £125,000 less for clubs. It's not really going to make any difference. When clubs do get promoted from League Two to League One, the wage bills do go up. So therefore, you'd expect the income to go up. And again, no disrespect to clubs in League Two, because you and I are both the same, Kevin. We'll go and watch any match in any division. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think there's plenty of other fans that will do the same. But yeah, we've said a lot recently. If you take a look at League One at present, yeah, Sheffield Wednesday, Sunderland, yeah, Portsmouth, Charlton, yeah, Ipswich. There's some really big hitters in that division with which also generate decent audiences from a TV point of view. You've only got to look at the iFollow sales of some of those clubs as well. I don't think anybody objects to clubs in higher divisions earning more from TV because they generate more traction as far as the viewership is concerned.
Next question comes from Gary Porter. It's an interesting one. Gary Porter says that Everton and Leeds have somewhat surprisingly opened retail outlets side by side in Belfast city centre. Do these clubs have any links in their retail arms? And has anything similar happened elsewhere? And then says they'll hardly make millions.
Well, his final sentence is quite prophetic, as we will see. What Leeds and Everton decided to do was to pick up half of a store each, which was vacated by Rangers, who we've just been talking about in Belfast. Now, in terms of the relationships, the Leeds store, it was effectively being operated by JD Sports, and Everton's store was being operated by Fanatics. So both of those organisations are independent. Fanatics is sort of a merchandise company, which I think is based in the US.
Yeah.
These were opened with big fanfare. You know, both clubs saying, "Yeah, we're fully aware that we've got fan bases in Northern Ireland. We want to be able to reach out to the fans to get them, give them an opportunity to acquire more merchandise, make it easier for them, and so on." So both of these stores were effectively opened in November 2021. In February 2022, both of them went on the market.
Oh,
so
right.
It's simply not been. It's not been as successful as the clubs had hoped for. I understand it is a 10-year lease that has been signed, and that's it's yeah, nothing ventured, nothing gained. But I think the level of interest has not been as high as either institution had hoped.
Well, especially in these days of Amazon and various other parcel delivery services, and also I find from personal experience that most fans, if they want to go to a club shop, they will wait till they go to the club. They'd much rather, a lot of those Northern Irish fans will save up and have maybe, some of them will be season ticket holders and going every week, but some of them will be going once a season as a treat maybe, and then the first place they'll go to is the club shop. It's much more exciting to be in the club shop on club day than just another shop in a retail centre, really. So it's an interesting one. So you think they just overestimated the amount of support they had in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, or either that, or as you say, opening a store in November.
Yeah,
most people have already bought their kits for the season.
That's true.
When do you buy? Yeah, okay. Christmas is a market, but it's not that huge a market unless you are a huge club. And this is no disrespect, because Leeds and Everton are both fantastic clubs with fantastic committed fan bases. But when I think of Everton, somebody that's worked in Liverpool for most of my working life, I always associate Everton as the people's club of L4.
Mm.
And it's got a local fan base. Are there Everton fans in Northern Ireland? Absolutely. It's the same with Leeds. Leeds is it is that one city club. Yes, Leeds has got huge support from a legacy point of view, from the glory years going back, but it tends to be quite sporadic compared to, we know that Manchester United and Liverpool, especially in Ireland, are incredibly popular, and you factor in Rangers and Celtic as well as being very popular in Northern Ireland. It means that clubs such as Everton and Leeds are fighting over a pretty small population of prospective fans in order to get interest.
Yeah, don't let Newcastle fans hear you say that there's another city with only one club in it, like Leeds, because that doesn't fit into their narrative. I think there's about 24 cities in town with only one club in it, but that's for another pod.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Patrick Fullerton says, you've spoken in the past about multiple club ownership models like Man City's, and also how players can typically get an increased wage when they move for a free transfer. Could you, in theory, purchase a lower league or cheap foreign team with the idea of snapping up top players on free transfers on the grounds of then having complete control over their loan deals, allowing them to decide where they want to go and how long for?
I think this is one of these things which looks good in theory, but why would a player, even a player on a Bosman, want to go to a second or third tier team in Belgium and then not know where they're going to be playing for the next 12 months because they're going to be stuck out on loan? So from a financial point of view, from a theoretical point of view, it looks okay, and I think it would work really well perhaps on Football Manager. But if I was a football player, and I was a good football player who'd stuck out, you know, we've got the likes of Paul Pogba awaiting his contract to expire at Manchester United this summer. Well, Paul Pogba wants degree of certainty. You know, he's still only 28.
Yeah.
He will want a 5-year contract, and also I suspect he will want to live in a city such as Madrid or Paris or London or Turin, as opposed to going to a lower tier club and then be loaned out purely to make money for another club. You know, the great thing from Paul Pogba's point of view and for, you know, Kylian Mbappe's point of view is that they are very much in control of their destiny. And you know, in terms of Patrick's suggestion, that control would effectively be passed back to another club.
Mm. Now, at the live show, Kieran, 10 days ago now, doesn't time fly, we had 250 people, and I think 230 of them probably put questions into our bucket.
Yes.
That makes it sound slightly less glamorous than it was. It was a modified bucket, let's put it that way. But to placate the angry crowds, Kieran, we had to say that we would ask some of these questions on future pods, which is what we intend to do. So the final questions on this week's show come from people who put questions in the bucket, and we didn't get round to them. And the first one is Chris Green. And this probably would have been a nicer question to ask you to your face, Kieran.
Yes, I wonder why.
I'm guessing. I think Chris sounds like the sort of bloke who would have marched up the front to do so as well. Chris says, given the altruistic nature of Port Vale's owners to bring success and growth to the community via football, which is something we talked about just a couple of pods back, is there any real enjoyment, Kieran, is there any real enjoyment to be had from the achievements of the likes of Brentford and Brighton and Stoke, given their reliance on gambling for financial backing?
I think it's an interesting question from Chris. I started supporting Brighton in the 1970s. So, you know, when you start supporting a club, you accept, especially, and we've had this conversation on more than one occasion. You know it's a lifelong commitment, and you take the slings and arrows. So, yeah, I've had all four divisions. I've done 117 grounds watching us normally be pretty rubbish, but that's never been the point. The enjoyment from the achievements, yeah, because I like you. You know, we've done the marches, we've done the petitions, we've done the pleading. We even had a song in the top 20 as part of our campaign to get us a new ground. Mm. And would that have been achieved without the wealth of Tony Bloom? I don't know. It's a simple answer. I think there were attempts to put money together. We were the first to admit that that our owner has funded the club with huge amounts of generosity. Would have he had a club in which he could have invested all of his money had it not been for the efforts of and the people who know, you know, the people that you know and I know who stood up for Palace, who stood up for Brighton, who are standing up for Rochdale at present and Oldham and all of these other clubs. No, he wouldn't. So it's a collaborative effort. Yes, there are people of incredible generosity, such as the Coates family, Matthew Benham, Tony Bloom, who have made money from the gambling industry. Absolutely. But once you start to go into the depths of individual clubs and trying to find out where their owners made their money from, is it any better that your owner was a hedge fund manager or a petrochemicals superstar or whatever, as opposed to gambling? That's that's I think down to people's own moral judgments. Yeah, we've already spoken. I've placed a bet on today's match. Sure. Now I'm not opposed to gambling. Yeah. I'm not very keen on the excesses of the way that the gambling industry operates and some of its business practices. I consider to be very reprehensible, and that's why we've had people on the show to articulate that, and that's also why we've turned money down. As far as this show is concerned, both from sponsorship and opportunities to buy out the show. It's just that where you as an individual decide to put your line in the sand is down to you. I don't support Brighton over Albion because we're in the Premier League and we've got a nice fluffy stadium. I do it because it's my life, same as yours.
Yeah, how well I remember that weekend when we were offered a huge amount of money by a gambling site to sponsor us, and how we discussed it and how bitterly I resented the fact that I was outvoted 2-1. Because I would have taken it, Kieran. That's not true. I tell you, Kieran, without whom success for your club would not have been achieved, who very rarely gets any thanks, and that's me.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, the reason why I was so keen to approach you to come on this show, for people that don't remember – or aren't familiar, when Brighton were on life support, we were doing all types of things to try to raise money. And I remember Kevin, as a Palace fan, doing a gig to raise money to help us to survive. And I've never forgotten that. And I'll be honest, that was one of the reasons why I was so keen to approach you to come on the show, to host the show, because I've had huge admiration for you from afar for over two decades.
Yeah, Phil. Well, thank you, Kieran. I've never forgotten it either because you still haven't paid my train fare. So, the one reason I'll do it if you pay the train. Yeah, of course. Lovely. Always nice to have a night in Brighton, especially after being half shouted at and half applauded by 300 confused Brighton fans who really didn't know how to respond to the fact that this twat from Palace was doing it for nothing for them. Our penultimate question is our second question from the live show, and it comes from Josh Ayres. And it's one of those questions where initially I think, oh, I know the answer to this question. And then I think about it and I don't know if I do, given my background in broadcasting. But Josh Ayres' question is, who pays for the camera crews at Premier League games? And is the same footage shown by all broadcasters?
Right. I think as far as Sky is concerned, they do the vast majority of the work themselves. They will outsource perhaps some of the matches, probably at EFL level, so not so at Premier League level. You know, Sky have paid so much money for the rights. They want complete control. So therefore, you know, it will be their staff. You know, they will have direct links to the to Jeff Stelling, who is great news, is carrying on.
Yeah.
And is the same footage shown by all broadcasters? As far as I'm aware, it is. It's the director or producer at each ground is making those cuts, making those decisions. And remember, these matches are going out live. Yeah, whilst we only get 100 and sorry, we only get 200 out of the 380 matches shown live on terrestrial, on satellite television here in the UK. For most of the international markets, every single match is going out live, and those feeds are determined by Sky, who then sell the rights to, or rather sort of are delegated to distribute the rights via the Premier League to the individual broadcasters overseas.
Yeah, everyone gets the same coverage. The difficulty for Sky is Saturdays like this, which are unusual. There's seven games today. There's only so many camera crew in the country, which is why if you're a young person listening to this and you're thinking about being an accountant or a comedian or an archaeologist, don't. Become a cameraman. You'll never be without work. Get yourself a little shoulder camera. And also, apparently, they are catnip to women. All cameramen think they are the most attractive people in the country. They think they're like Grand Prix drivers because they've got a camera on their shoulder. It's just sickening. So if it wasn't for them, North Face would have been out of business years ago. our final question. Now, this is an interesting one because we've talked about this quite a lot recently, especially since we had Millwall's chief executive on the show, talking about a Premier League 2, or at the very least branding the Championship as a Premier League 2. And Dale Savage asks, is there really commercial value in a Premier League 2 apart from being free of the EFL?
I think it's an interesting one to investigate further. Will ultimately the eyeballs be focused on Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea and so on? Absolutely, they will. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But I think the potential benefits of Premier League 2 is that it would involve a more equitable distribution model of money. And yeah, we've been talking about clubs losing money, but why are they losing money? The clubs in the top half of the Championship, or some of the clubs, because you know, we know that likes of Coventry and Luton have done fantastically well this season, they've got an incentive to overspend. And the incentive to overspend is that their TV money goes from £7 million to £100 million. Why have the clubs at the bottom of the Premier League got an incentive to overspend? Because they know that their TV money goes from £100 million to £40 million with parachute payments and then down to £7 million within 3 years. So if we could have a top two divisions where there is greater fluidity in terms of the finances, then the incentive to overspend would diminish. And some of the eye-watering numbers that we've seen reported over the course of the last couple of months probably wouldn't be there, because if you get relegated, yes, it's not as good, but it is, you know, it is catastrophic, especially if parachute payments don't exist under the present model system. The downside is that, you know, would it be a closed shop of 44 or 40 clubs or whatever it's going to be? Where does it leave those clubs that we've just been talking about in League One, such as Sheffield Wednesday, Sunderland, Ipswich, Wigan, Charlton, Pompey, and so on? Because if all of the money's concentrated in the top two divisions, then the big cliff edge starts between the bottom of PL2 and the start of what is presently League One. So I've spent ridiculous numbers of hours spreadsheeting, advising people who I can't mention about, you know, how, you know, if we did this, what are the implications? There is no one system that works. That's unfortunately the answer.
Thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site. If you'd like to join them, make a small monthly contribution to the pod. That was almost an unfortunate spoonerism. A small monthly contribution to the pod. Always free to AirPod, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. Don't think too much about it. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, then email us, of course, at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thanks for all the support you give to us. It is appreciated. Patreon is one method of doing that. Another is to go to your app through which you download your podcasts. And if you could give us a review, it makes a difference, according to Producer Guy. The more reviews you get, the algorithm that's used by the likes of Apple and Spotify and Google and whoever it is tends to knock you up the table a little bit. So if you could give us 5 stars, only if you think we're worthy of it, of course. So yeah, we are appreciative. You know, this is a podcast where people of opposing views, you know, Crystal Palace and Brighton, we've come together to try to occupy your earwaves. And if we can do it, you could even say, why not have it hosted by Chris Rock and Will Smith? And that again, that might bring people of opposing views together, and that could be a good thing.
Yeah, I bet Chris Rock and Will Smith get their train fare paid. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.